For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we are in 1 Thessalonians. We're in chapter 4. This is the third week out of, I guess, 3, maybe 4, I don't know. Forget what we're going to do next time. Where we're talking about the subject of sex. And tonight we're going to talk about sex and teenagehood. And the reason why we're doing that is because we got into this study a few weeks ago from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where Paul says this. He says, this is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, that you abstain, he says, from sexual immorality, that each of you know how to possess his own body, that is, his vessel, in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who don't know God. Let no one sin against or defraud their brother or sister in this matter, because the Lord is the avenger in all these things. Just as we told you before and solemnly warned you, God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but sanctification. So he who rejects this is not rejecting man, but God who gives us the Holy Spirit. That's the text we've been looking at for these last several weeks. And if you're here sort of new to this whole discussion about the Bible, you may find yourself on a lot of levels kind of weirded out by this passage, because it does really come in the face of a lot of our basically accepted notions of sexuality in our culture, and that's why we felt like we needed to interact with some depth on this issue, but also because of the weird terms that are used, this sanctification, the will of God. You know, that's not a word we use very often in our culture, sanctification. When's the last time you threw that out in polite conversation? Probably not recently. I haven't, certainly. I've never even heard of this word before, except for in the context of Christians talking about their faith. It's one of these words that was commonly used in the ancient Greek-speaking world. It's not so commonly used today. But for some reason, our translators like to hang on to those archaic words that we don't anymore use and don't give us dynamic equivalents for. So I'm going to do that. What is Paul saying? He says, the will of God is that you're distinct, sanctified. That's what that means, hagios. It means that you're set apart by God for a purpose that's distinct, that's different, that's like God is. And in all areas of life, when you think about, okay, how is God and what does God have to say and how is that different than the way people live their lives or the opinions that people hold? I think probably in no place could this be more acute, more specific, more significant than in the area of sexuality. And so Paul is saying to these Greco-Roman people of the first century that God is going to call us to be distinct in a lot of the ways that we live our lives, and in the sexual area, that's a real big one. And he talks about being distinct from the rest of the culture in terms of what he calls lustful passion, immorality, impurity. Pornea is the word there. That's where we get the word pornography from. It's that obsession with sexuality outside of the committed bounds of heterosexual monogamous marriage. And, you know, that's just a way that the ancient world thrived. That's the way they looked at sex. That's the way we look at sex today. And so we've been talking about the difference between this idea of sexuality as the Bible lays it out and as both ancient and contemporary culture look at sex from the standpoint of three basic assumptions that we've drawn into question. The first is that sex is not a moral issue. That's certainly the idea in our culture, that, you know, the stomach is for food. If you're hungry, you should eat. You got other organs that have similar kinds of urges. They ought to be satisfied. And it's not like a right or wrong type of thing. It's just that this is the way that we're equipped. And, you know, if God gave us the equipment, then by God, we ought to use it. All right? Amen. Okay. But see, you know, that's not really true when we reflect upon it. You know, all cultures, including our own, clearly understand that sexuality does have connections to morality. That's why we talk about sexual abuse. It'd be impossible to talk about an abusive sexual relationship if sex was just a purely amoral thing like eating. We talked about the central dogma of our culture that whatever consenting adults are into, that's good for them. And we made the point that, yeah, okay, on a legal basis, okay, that's true. We probably don't want to be legislating what people do in their bedrooms and so forth. But from a different standpoint, from the standpoint of what is really being assumed here, that it's just these are victimless crimes and we do what we want to do and there's no effect outside of ourselves. Not so. And so we've talked about the fact that that sexuality outside of the commitment of marriage has brought a lot of difficulties into our culture in terms of divorce, in terms of children being raised in these deeply conflicted, oftentimes families, that we don't express our sexuality in a vacuum. And lastly, that the sexual view of the ancient world, just like in our culture, that look, you know, it's just something that I'm into, it's what I do or whatever. What I do with my body doesn't affect my spirit, my soul. That also is not true. And that the sexual act is a connection with people on a very deep level, emotionally, psychologically, and physically, and spiritually. And this is why the Old Testament's use of the verb to know is most commonly used for the sexual act, the sexual relationship, because it is communication at a very deep level. To know someone and to be bound with them sexually is to bring together two really complete worlds into a shared world of experience. Well, you know, we spent a few weeks on this, and so this is just a real brief overview. You might want to pick up the CDs if you want a little bit more background. But tonight we want to focus our attention on an area that I think, if you're not presently concerned about this, you will be at some point, and that is sexuality as it relates to our children, which I think is so hard of a topic to deal with. I've got a kid who's, or Linda and I do, who's out of teenagehood now, I guess at this point, and another who's just moved into it. So it's a hot topic around our household, kind of a big deal. There's a lot associated with it. We realize at a certain point that my kid's on a wind-up toy. You know, when they're little, they are kind of like wind-up toys. You tell them what to do, and they do it usually. And then you can exercise high levels of control. But at a certain point, your kid is going to square off with you, either verbally into your face, like mine, and say, you can't be everywhere I am. You can't know everyone I know. You can't know everything I do. So there. Or more subtly, maybe your kid will adopt more of a smarmy, subtle, you know, put on the nice face, but do other things behind your back. You know, that happens as well. The point is that when kids become, you know, pubescent and adolescent, they get moved into their teenage years, they're confronted with a very different world that they had previously not really connected with in a significant way, and things begin to change. We need to talk about that some here tonight. We find that in this area of adolescent sexuality, for parents as well as for children, there's a lot of confusion about this, a lot of fear, frankly, on this subject. There is a lot of failure, and because there's a lot of failure, both for children and for their parents, there's a lot of guilt. There is also, unfortunately, among both children and parents sometimes that have been successful in this area, sometimes a level of pride that's not helpful. But the point is that there's a whole range of things, and I think that when we're concerned as a household about the issue of sex in relation to our kids, there are very few things that are more disruptive, that are more potentially painful and difficult to work through as a family than this. And so I don't really anticipate answering all the questions that that raises here tonight. We're not going to be able to do that. But maybe just to introduce the right categories for us to begin thinking and having conversation that would enable us to really kind of seize hold of God's view of these things and find his way through them. That would be my hope. And I definitely want to urge you too, who are here tonight and Maybe you're single, maybe you're married, but you don't have kids. Maybe your kids are still in the wind-up phase. You have a role to play. We are a community. And I believe that the concerns that parents have here with teenage kids, early adolescent kids, are not just the concerns that they should have as a household, but are concerns that we as their friends and as a broader community, we also have a role to play. And I want to talk about that in just a little while, but I just want to plead with you as you sit here. You say, well, I don't have kids who fit into this description or whatever. Don't tune out. You know, most of you who don't will. And all of you have a role to play as we begin to engage these important topics. Some of you, in your own psychological and emotional makeup, have not really resolved the sexual experiences of your own adolescence and have had a huge effect on the unfolding of your life even down to the present. All of us, I think, will find that this is very important information to consider. I want to talk about it from two real specific perspectives and then draw some conclusions. First, I want to talk about the issue of identity. Identity. This is sort of a big deal with children as they come into adolescence. They realize that they're not just an appendage of mom and dad. And they begin to raise these questions about, you know, who am I? And that sounds very abstract. And in some ways, it really is, but it is a real process that goes on as an individual begins to realize that I am an individual. I'm not merely the extension of a parent or a set of parents. And so by 11, 12, 13 years old, boys and girls begin to raise these questions about, am I normal? And so being normal is kind of a big deal. However they may define normality, it matters to them that they fit in, that they feel a part of, that they are not weird in social definitions. Am I desirable? Yes, your child wants to resolve that question. It is in their mind. It's not clear to them that they are desirable. This is why they will spend not 30 seconds like they used to in front of the mirror brushing their teeth and combing their hair, but 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half an hour fussing and wondering, do I really look okay? And then they walk away from the mirror having forgotten whether or not they were really acceptable on that level, and then they go back and look again. And so there is a lot of just navel gazing, mirror looking, and self-oriented. It's a real self-oriented kind of time. And they're asking this question, am I desirable on a sexual level? Do I matter? Is my life significant in any way? Am I an important person? We need to have answers to those questions. Am I unique? Is there anything about me that makes me distinct from other people, my own person with my own identity, things like this. And these are natural things that all adolescent kids are going through. Some of us never get out of adolescence, so we're still kind of grinding through that question. Maybe that's what midlife crisis is about, I don't know. But anyway, the point is that those questions are on the back burner and are really important drivers behind why people involve themselves in the sort of activity they do at this age and how sex relates. Because sex, in our culture, is a means of establishing these elements of identity. Superficially, yes, but sex in the popular literature, in popular culture, in the things that are affecting our adolescents, sex tells them, yes, I am normal, that I have these drives and I can satisfy them because I see that in the media, I see that among friends and so forth. Sex tells me that, yes, I am desirable. It's a very immediate answer to that question, isn't it? And so boys, and especially girls, learn that they can, in fact, have a fair amount of influence and control over the behavior of members of the opposite gender by the way they dress and by the way they carry themselves and interact. And they can create that sense of being desired very easily in our culture. And so for a lot of reasons, not just the fact that their bodies are going through a unique moment in time, but socially and psychologically, there's a development here where sex and identity are two things that are really coming together in a powerful way. And our culture increasingly is a very sexual culture at an earlier and earlier stage in development. And I think that there is good reason for us to be concerned as parents and as a community here tonight about this fact that it is the norm in our culture for young people to establish their identity through sexual means. And the thing that is so concerning to me, I think, really is how inadequate sex is as a way to reinforce identity. Let's think about this here just for a couple of minutes. You know, statistics tell us that by the time a child graduates high school, well, over 75% of them have had a sexual experience, intercourse, or something along those lines. That's a big number. And they're doing it for reasons largely for what we're describing here. And they're finding themselves really not being able to, through sexual encounters, develop that sense of identity that they by nature need to have developed. And instead, they're developing other things. I like the way Alan Bloom puts it in his book, The Closing of the American Mind, when he talks about young people and youth culture and the openness of sexuality in our day. This is what he says. He says, women in particular are pleased by their freedom and their capacity to chart an independent course for themselves. But he says, they frequently suspect that they are being used, that in the long run, they may need men more than men need them, and that they cannot expect much from the feckless contemporary male. Because women pursue sexual relationships as a means of establishing intimacy with a man. Okay? And men pursue sexual intimacy as a substitute for personal intimacy, by and large. That's a generalization, but it's generally true. And so in a culture then where there are no real limits to the exercise of sexuality, where we have all this sexual freedom, what Bloom and so many others have pointed out is that there is that sense that in the name of freedom, I'm really being ripped off. Because what does casual sexual practice really mean at the end of it, insofar as my identity is concerned? Let's think about that. It means that my acceptance, my desirability, is conditional. I'm valuable, I matter as long as I satisfy what you're wanting from me. It means that I'm accepted and that my identity is rooted in the most superficial of things. It's about how you look. And so there is that neurosis, especially again among adolescent girls, to fit a certain pattern, a certain look, and all of the crazy modern day neurotic, you know, bulimia and anorexia and weird stuff like that that comes out of the pressure that young people sense. That it's all about how I look, my identity, my desirability, it's all tied in that. And then, too, of course, They learn that their value is a temporary and fleeting thing. You know, you're fine, and as long as you deliver, as long as you fit this physical mold, and you're okay until something better comes along, and it's at that point that basically I'm tired of you. And all the baggage that you bring into this relationship, and so I'm done and I'm moving on. And that is largely the way it is in sex and the youth culture. And I want to ask this question: what does this do to a young person's sense of identity and value to realize that basically it's conditional, it's superficial, and it's temporary? What psychological, emotional, spiritual effect does sexuality play in a culture that defines people's value in these terms? What do you think? What kind of price are people paying for the way that we view sex in youth culture today? What do you think?
It makes them pretty sarcastic and cynical about, you know, things that just seem so idealistic, like hope, like love. You know, I mean, if you make it conditional and superficial and temporary, then there isn't any wholeness about those kinds of ideas, and they don't really exist. So you settle for something even less, like on anything that's important to you.
Yes. I do think that there's a connection between cynicism and sex among young people, absolutely. I think that's a very important point. Who else has a thought? Jill?
So I'm 28, and I was anorexic over this. Yeah. You know, I learned it in seventh or eighth grade, that I was loved if I looked thin, you know, if I looked good. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, 4 years after the fact or so, 3 or 4 years. And this is still so hard for me, you know, and it's just, it ruined my life for a really long time, you know, and I still think about it, and I'm so sorry, and I'm so sick that I did that, you know, and that I let it get to me that much. And now 4 years after being a Christian, I wrestle with it daily, trying just to let God heal this stuff, you know.
Yes.
So it's really... it's miserable, you know, the way that our culture is like this.
Thanks. I imagine there's quite a few people who could identify exactly with what you're saying, Jill. Who else has a thought about this over here?
It just really distorts your view of what love truly is. And, it becomes very performance-based. I have to look this way. I have to act this way. I have to do these things in order to get this love. Whereas God's love and how God wants us to love is strictly out of grace. And so.
I'm not good enough. I wonder if I'm good enough. So there's always that doubt in your mind that gets reinforced by rejection. Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, John?
I think ultimately it leads to a sense of isolation, because if you're looking, you know, outward, and then you're constantly looking for your satisfaction outward, and this conditional, superficial, temporary viewpoint is what you're getting, then you have no other basis to reach out to other people but your own selfishness. And so you're just going to, I think, probably out of self-protection, isolate yourself in order to feel healthy, in order to not hurt.
So yes, the fear of being rejected, of being written off, and so forth, turns you inward into sort of a narcissistic, fear-based approach to other people, other relationships. So the very thing that you seek to establish your value, your identity, you have, in essence, walled yourself off from being able to experience. And so as a consequence, then we have a whole generation of people emerging. And many of us here tonight, as Jill has pointed out, this isn't like new, you know, who are walking around as deeply wounded people, unable to really draw near in a significant, vital relationship with other people, because to be vulnerable is to be ripped off. To be valuable is to be something that's very superficial and physical.
I know that when I was a teenager, it was very important for me to fit in and be normal.
Yeah.
And one of the things is, you know, it's like if you're not sexual, then that's not normal.
Right.
As a teenager.
That's right.
And so, you know, like your value goes down. Your identity is you are on the outside at that point. And it's scary as a teenager to be different than everybody else.
A social deviant. Yes. A person who's sexually abstinent is a social deviant in a very substantial part of youth culture today. Absolutely, that's true. Who else has a thought? Melissa.
Just going to add to the point you were making just a second ago about how it affects us over the long term. Having always used sex in my younger years as something to feel all of those identity, to feel desired and all the things you were talking about, when you get married then, and all of a sudden you're in an unconditional, intimate, permanent relationship, it's taken significant relearning. You know, how do you do sex when you get married? It's just really different. So it's been hard, but cool.
Thanks. These are all really great points, and I think that the depth of your observations reflect the significance of this topic. Here's the point, that what teens in our culture especially seek for in sexual relationships, their identity, their desirability, their value, their normality, can really only come not from being sexually active, but rather through a deep, positive, emotional connection with, primarily, parents, yes. You may be feeling like you're being pushed to the periphery of your kid's life, but I can tell you absolutely that it's this that's really going on with your adolescent kid. And there is a strong need to be affirmed, to have emotional warmth, real physical affection with your adolescent boys and girls, your teenage kids. Because that does create a strong sense of their desirability, their normality, their uniqueness, the fact that they are significant to you. And beyond that as well, not just parents, but also close friends. You know, one of the things that I treasure so much about the relationships that my wife and I, our family enjoys in our little outpost of the body of Christ, our little experience of the church, is the significant number of people that have been a part of our family over many, many years now. Young couples, single people, all kinds of folks who have taken interest, not just in my wife and I, but also interest in our children, and who have enormous influence on our kids because they care about them, and because our kids can oftentimes relate to older people who are not our parents and learn from them, and really, you know, that gives them a sense of significance there as well. And so, you know, for my daughter, who is at, you know, 13 at this stage of the game, for her to be able to have a real familiarity and an enjoyment with some of the women who are in our adult home group, which I know she does have as she babysits their kids and stuff, is important to her identity, to her security, to her confidence that she is okay and she doesn't have to lay herself bare before others to satisfy their desires for her to become a desirable person. So this is why, you know, these are issues of our whole community. They're not just issues for parents with adolescent kids. And I just feel very strongly that everyone here has a role to play in the parenting of the people, of the children in our church. You just do. When we are able to connect with kids, we communicate their true value, they feel secure, they accept it for who they are, not what they can do for somebody else to gain that sense of identity. Some of us are going to have to find that we're going to have to actually ramp up the level of contact that we have with our kids as they enter into this turbulent phase of life. Spend more time. Be able to kind of put the things that maybe bother us to the side a little bit more so that we can keep the doors open in relationship with them, to keep it warm so that there isn't that sense of distance from us, which social psychologists have shown over and over and over again lead to increased interest in sex among young people. We've got to move towards our younger people in this way. It's a big deal, and they make it hard, don't they? Sex is not needed to secure identity, and that's what we need to be able to communicate through the way we conduct our family, through how we involve the resources of the body of Christ and have a bearing on our kids. We want our kids to not feel that they have that overwhelming need that so many of their peers do. Now let's talk about culture and conformity, second major category here, because youth culture is conformist culture, isn't it? It's all about fitting in. It's like being like the rest. It's that need to belong. And kids feel that need to belong because they're moving past the narrow limitations of their nuclear families, and they're discovering a social identity that's broader than them. And they need to feel that sense of belonging. It's just like, you know, you walk into the lunchroom of the high school cafeteria, and what do you see? What's happening there? Well, you got your geek table, your nerd table, your jock table, your goth table. You got all these people who are just desperately trying to identify with themselves because they need to belong to some sort of group to get that sense of identity there. And this relates to sex as well, because youth culture, especially in our day, is increasingly the subject of gross commercial exploitation. And I just want to lay this out to you. I'm not going to defend it. You can do your own research. But a good place to start would be Frontline, which is a very reputable PBS investigative journalism program. Did a program a few years ago called The Merchants of Cool. We have that at the study center. I just urge parents to sit down with their kid and watch what it looks like to bring the world of advertising, popular music, media, all these things together that are very self-consciously working together to create a view of what does it mean to be a teen and then market their product specifically along those lines. And it is overtly and grotesquely sexual. And these are the kinds of things that the messages that our kids are being bombarded with constantly, every time they cue in on the internet and they're looking at Facebooks, they're cueing in to MTV or whatever it is, they're getting a very unified message that it's important to be sexual and it's important to be sexually active. And that's just a fact that we're able to spin for reasons of bottom line what you should look like to belong. What you need to think to belong. What kind of attitudes you must have to belong. And, you know, all I can say is that we need to pull our heads out of the sand and realize that we are up against very powerful market-driven forces in our culture when we talk about establishing sexual identity with young people. It's just a fact. Not to hide from it, not to say, no, you can't watch TV anymore, and, you know, the internet's from the devil, and all this kind of stuff. We're not saying that. But if we're not engaged, if we're not sitting down and listening to that music together, and watching videos together, and sitting down and watching things like Frontline together, and having conversation, then we're living in two worlds. And we're not helping our kids. Let's talk about sex with Jenny and Tad Hale.
We work in the high school ministry. We've been working and leading a high school home church for 10 or 11, 12 years?
15 years.
15 years.
Today it seems like they're much more knowledgeable, experienced, and curious at a younger age. One of the things that really surprised me when we first got involved with high school ministry was a situation in Westerville where students had established a circle of friends, which basically meant that because you were friends with this person, you could call them up at any point in time and ask them to come and have sex with you. And it was not a small circle. We're talking, you know, 30, 40, 50 students, some involved in the fellowship, some involved in other churches.
I see more experimentation with different types of sexuality. And since I work with the girls a lot more often, I see a lot of experimental making out with other girls and trying to figure out, who am I? Am I gay? Am I bi?
Where do I fit in? And I think that opens them up to a lot of peer pressure, because to find out, do I fit in with this group of students, I need to participate in what they're into. And so maybe they go to a party not thinking, well, I wonder if I'm bi or homosexual, but I'm there and these girls are making out and all the guys think it's cool. Maybe to fit in with this group, I need to experiment and try that out. I don't think they're knowingly rebelling against what God wants. They just don't know any difference. And they look around and they say, this is what humans do. And very unaware of the consequences that they're going to suffer.
Some of the most sexually active students that I've known are the most defended, the most guarded, and the most mistrusting. And if they're girls, often they don't have close girlfriends. It's fed by, you know, the hip-hop image, too, that, you know, I can gain power over men by being sexual and attracting them to some images. It does work. They get a following.
The casualness of it is really shocking. Even in the past 15 years, it's become more and more casual, and it's really no big deal to go from one person, one partner, to another. There's no stigmatism attached. And when it comes to things like making out, you know, we'll talk to students who will make out with 3, 4, 5 people on a weekend.
There's a lot of girls that never date, never have a committed relationship throughout high school, but are better, very sexually active. So, you know, you don't have to have a steady boyfriend to be sexually active.
One of the big things that we've tried to do is be open and honest and keep dialogues open with our kids, age-appropriate dialogues.
I kind of just toughed it out. I'd pray and I'd have that level of conviction that this conversation has to happen, and even if it's just me saying something, I can't leave it unspoken. It never flowed smoothly, though. I can't say, oh, it was great once we got rolling. It was always awkward.
They'd go to parties in middle school, and there'd be, the thing to do would be to, you know, flash the boys, you know, pull up your shirt and show the boys how you're developing. You know, a circle would form, and a couple would get in the middle and make out and kind of perform. And you know, this stuff that was going on 6th, 7th grade, and our kids would come back and tell us about some of these things, and pretty shocking. You know, we'd make a point to not leave them there that long. A lot of times, you know, yeah, you can go to that Halloween party, but you're going to be there for an hour, and then we're going to pick you up, and we're going to go do something as a family. Our kids like rap music, and, you know, you watch rap videos, and they're pretty raw. And so we always talk about that, okay, the music and the images are both kind of raw and have a really negative view and a low view of women and of human sexuality, but they're fun. There's a sense in which the beat and some of it's really clever and stuff. So we're not saying you can't watch that, but we're dialoguing about, you know, the content and the concepts behind there.
I think they need to be cynical toward the things that are evil, and they need to have hope toward the things that are good. And they do desire hope. I mean, you can talk to students, they're like, I want to have a good marriage. We have a lot of students that will say to us, I want to have a life, I want to have a marriage like yours, and I want to be a good family. Their involvement in their own community of Christians played a monstrous role, just for building convictions and supporting, you know, their desire to walk with God And on a really practical level, it gave them a community of friends that they could hang out with on weekend nights. There's a lot of weekend nights as you're growing up.
We talked about sex. We talked about the fact that Jenny and I have sex and that we enjoy it. At least I enjoy it.
The one thing you don't want to communicate and that you're very careful not to communicate is sex is bad. The idea is sex is great, and it was by God's design, and as you grow with him, it'll be even better. And to have a positive spin rather than, no, it's bad, I think that's really important. It's like, you know, the vision out there, what the real design is supposed to be.
All right, well, there's a lot to think about there. I was really taken aback by Jenny's comment that it is important for our children to be cynical about the things that they should be cynical about and have hope for the things that we need to have hope about. And I think cultivating the right kinds of attitudes are crucial in terms of cultivating the ability to make the kind of decisions that kids are going to need to make when they're in situations that they have not planned for and not really considered all that well. And just to have that emotional and mental preparation in view is important to them. Let's talk about this idea of, you know, to be sanctified, as we said earlier. It means to be distinct. What does it mean for us to be distinct as opposed to conform to the culture in the sexual area as a young person? I want to just briefly mention three key areas that we really need to have nailed down. The first is community. As again, people are always seeking for how do I fit in, where do I belong. We are social beings by nature, pack animal, you know, whatever it is. Community really does matter. And that means that on a positive level as well, the kind of community that we create for our young people is important. That peer power is a real thing, that parents are going to find that their influence changes over time. I was thinking of writing wanes over time or is written off over time because it can feel that way when your kid just doesn't engage you that much anymore. They're not talking to you like they once did. You know, they're not this cute little object that that they once were. Now they're kind of an awkward, bony, surly, unpleasant thing. You know what I mean. And you feel like, well, they're not listening because all I get back is a grunt or a snort or something like that. But the reality is that kids are deeply connected to their parents, that parental influence, while it changes, absolutely, it remains valuable to our kids. But their peers increasingly dominate the horizon for them in terms of what they will or will not do because they want to connect with that broader group. A kind of community that's going to help our kids view sexuality in a healthy way, in a desirable way, is a community that promotes self-giving to the benefit of others. You know, sex, as it's been wound up, it is narcissism in our day. It's validation that I am desirable, that I matter, that I'm normal, and I. And we have got to be able to help young people cultivate a real emotional connection with self-giving love that meets the needs of other people and the kind of fulfillment that comes from giving your life away. And I think that without that sort of a framework of compassion, of interest in the lives of others, of course it will be very difficult to not be caught up in the tsunami that is the sexual revolution of our day. In a community of young people, the capacity to have solid non-romantic relationships, very important with members of the opposite gender. I've been really pleased with our daughter, for instance, in middle school, getting into high school here in just a matter of months, that the group that she hangs with is both boys and girls, and it's a real positive, I think, kind of way that they interact together. I want to see that. I want to see that more and more, because then, you know, you don't have to worry about, am I desirable to this boy or whatever, because there's somebody there that is just my friend. And most males and females, certainly in the high school age, don't have friends of the opposite gender. The opposite gender for them is a conquest to be made. And so this is going to be an important area for us. We really need to think in terms of the inclusiveness of our own household and our open door policy. I've felt that it's been very important for Linda and me, and she, my wife, has really led the way in this in our household, is that she, you know, makes it really easy for our kids' friends to hang at our house. And they like being there, and they pick up a sense of warmth, of identity, of acceptance, things like that, that they're not getting oftentimes at home, and they're certainly not getting in their broader social framework. And just to realize I've got a role to play not only in the lives of my children, but also the friends of my children, and to help them maintain, you know, being so socially engaged with our culture, so that they don't become these protected church kids or whatever, but they're a normal part of society, normal part of their own culture, but on their terms, on safe terms. And parents have an important role to play there. And so the willingness to tolerate the stink of the teenage boy, and let your house get trashed, and to not be worried about, you know, maybe some peripheral things that are barely legal and not advisable, but at least, you know, there's a connection there. We've got kids that are friends of our oldest who are 20, 21 years old, you know, that we still see periodically just because they like us. And there's been a role that we've been able to have in their life that I think has been significant to kind of making it through this turbulent age with a lot of failure absolutely along the way. Conversation. You got to keep it going. You got to talk. What does it look like? Well, what it looks like is sitting your kids down in an undistracted context and opening up a book and beginning to lecture them as much as possible on all of the things that they should be about. Right? Just tell them where it's at. And they'll listen. Right? Well, of course not. I speak as if insane. It doesn't work like that. It's dialogue. It's interaction. It's how do you feel about these things. It's throwing open-ended questions for which there's not a true and false response. And it's having that dialogue and engaging with them about their values, about their the pressures that they feel, about the things that they're experiencing in life. You know, one of the most interesting exercises we ever did with our oldest son was actually initiated by the high school that he went to. I think this was in ninth grade, maybe it was 10th, where they were doing sex in health class. And so the assignment that they gave was to take home a contract for each student to sit down with a parent and talk about what their view of sex is, whether they should be abstinent or not, what underlying values should inform decisions about sex, and they had to then turn around and turn that in. And I thought, good for them. Your tax dollars at work. That's a good thing. It forced parents to sit down in an open-ended way and say, what do you think about this? And here's what I think. And let's interact and let's talk about that. And if you're not having those kind of conversations, you're merely deferring to the culture to have that conversation with your kids. Somebody else will. That's right, Oscar. Somebody else will. And finally, you know, for our kids to have coherent and defensible convictions about sexuality is very important. And what I mean here is not that they just know the right rules and we have exercised total control over them. You know, I think rules matter. Curfews and things like that matter, absolutely. But if we think that we can control our kids into sexual purity and have appropriate sexual relationships with boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever, simply by legislating it, we're out of our mind. You're nuts. I just want to tell you, you will fail. Because kids know that you can't control them. Kids look at rules and they ask themselves one question. How can I break it? That's just the way kids are. You were that way, weren't you? Okay, maybe it's just me. Of course you were that way. Rules are meant to be broken. Limits are always there to be tested. And so legislating conduct and maybe holding out some sort of amorphous fear of the consequence that will happen if they get out of line basically is creating in our kid duplicity. They will lie to our face and behind our back do what they want. You hear me? They will tell you what you want to hear and they will defy you behind your back. If what we're doing is purely a rules-based, high-control approach to dealing with our kids' sexuality. What we want instead is to be able to engage our children about a biblical view of sexuality and a biblical view of people and of relationships. And we have spent weeks together talking about this on Sunday nights. And we need to be able to kind of consolidate that and talk about, you know, sex is not a problem to be avoided. It's a beautiful thing to be experienced. But what does that mean exactly? And why did God create us as sexual beings? And what does it mean to have a sexually fulfilling relationship? And what does our conduct towards other people say about what we believe is true of them and of us? And to have real convictions in this area, because it's only the internal mechanisms of an individual that will sustain them through the kind of decisions that they're going to need to make through their adolescence and on into their adult life. And we have got to be able to have those kinds of high-level conversations with our kids. If you're not there and you think to yourself, how would I even have a conversation like that? I just want to urge you to connect with somebody who knows how to do that in your home group or whatever. And talk that through, because this is too important to just defer to control and command and this type of thing. Last thing, I want us to just think about this. With our adolescent sons and daughters, we need to be thinking not about the person whom they are, but the person they're becoming. And this broader framework is really crucial, I think, in terms of their capacity to really be victorious in the area of their own sexuality. Adolescent years are times of transition. And there are, I think, key transition points that we want to be able to look at and know that real progress is being made in our kids' life in these areas. The first is that our child is going from taking from the needy to being a giver. What I mean by that is you get your kids over in that playroom over there, you know, the three-year-olds, and what do? They take their Nerf bats and, you know, pound the other kid over the head. They see that what that other kid's holding is something desirable for them, and so they go and they rip it out of their hands, and they're completely self-absorbed, aren't they? Okay, now, unfortunately, some people never get past that point. And that's a problem, and if you've got that problem in your life, then we can talk about that. But the reality is that adolescence is a time where we begin to transition from what does it mean to be a self-centered bag of need called a little child and into an adult whose focus and attention is out there. And that has a direct bearing on sex, because what we are wanting to be able to convey to our kids and what they need to be able to have real convictions about is the fact that if I move toward this young girl or this young boy and I allure him or her and I use their body to establish my own sense of desirability, normality, my identity, what am I doing? I'm stealing from them. I'm stealing from them. And these are people who don't have an answer. And they don't know what does it mean to have a healthy, positive identity. And I'm using their weakness to exploit them for my own self-interest. And that's gross and it's wrong. You see what I'm saying? And our kids need to be able to have that kind of conviction in their hearts. That to sexually move toward another person is to take from the needy. Why would I take what little this person has to found their dignity and their identity and their significance and just take it because I can get it? That's what a 2-year-old does in the romper room. And young boys learn what does it mean to just view women as a conquest to be made for reasons of my own self-interest. And young girls learn what does it mean for me to manipulate boys to get what I want. And it's sick. That works well on the African plain among animals. But that's not human sexuality. And I want my children to have enough dignity and value for the other person not to steal their most precious possession. Don't steal from them. That ability, you know, that goes along with this, I think, to begin to see in your child as they're developing the ability to defer gratification for the sake of a longer-term value, a longer-term good. And I think that we live in a very distraction-oriented society, and it's immediate, and it's what I want is available right now. And it's really hard, I think, to get this message across. But we need to find ways to help our adolescents understand the importance of delaying gratification, of being involved in things that take time to develop, that aren't fun at first. Sports often can play this role. There are different things that we can get our kids involved with where they begin to learn this message. My daughter's 13, and some of you know that she's always been about that much taller than everybody else her age. They're beginning to catch up now. But for her whole life, every time she would get involved in an activity with people her age, she'd stick out like a freak, you know? And was always very self-conscious about that. Swimming lessons, she hated them. Why? Because, you know, everyone else is like this to her. And so we get her into different kinds of sports and got her into basketball. What a mistake, you know? We thought, well, surely basketball, hell, all she has to do is stand there and get the ball. And, you know, no one's going to, she's like Greg Oden. But she hated that because, again, she stuck out and it was weird. Now she's been doing tennis now for about a year and a half, and she's in tennis lessons that are age appropriate and skill appropriate. And guess how tall the next person in her class comes to her? And it's, you know, so we have these conversations with her, and between Linda and me, and we're like, should we just pull the plug on this? This is killing her. But then we realize, you know, as hard as this is, she is really learning a skill that's not gratifying in any way because she has a vision for when she's in high school next year to be on the tennis team. And that is worth it. That's teaching her delayed gratification. It's teaching her that it's okay to feel awkward in the moment and things like that. And I think that that has a direct connection to the kind of conscience that we're trying to build in a person who's going to be in situations that we can't predict or control, where they're going to have to say, is it my impulse or have I learned some elements of self-control that enable me to pursue something that is not about this instant gratification opportunity that I have right in front of me. Trusting God or self with our own needs. That's another really important area here. Are they transitioning into adults that are not autonomous adults, which is to say not adults that are just all about themselves, but adults who are truly learning what does it mean for me to turn to God for my identity, for my sense of significance, to look to serving God with my life as being valuable and desirable. I want to be able to see that. We want to be able to see from our kids grace and humility and restoration. Because guess what, folks? I'm sorry to tell you, your kid is going to fail in a lot of areas and is very likely to fail along a continuum in the sexual area. Okay? They are very likely to fail in areas that offend you, that scare you, that sadden you, that anger you. And they need to learn what does it mean to stand under the grace of God. To understand what does it mean for me to have failed and to experience acceptance from God, the humility to admit that I'm wrong, the process of restoring my relationships with the people that I've wronged, including family members and others. And we want to be able to send our kids out the door with some experience in those areas. And if we're about those things, then we are creating the kind of conscience that will enable our kids to have the best chance of growing up and experiencing, you know, a healthy sexual life. Because, you know, and here's the last thing is that we want to be able to view our children as tomorrow's leaders, of people who can make a difference, as people who are whole in a broken world. And that's the vision I have for my children. I hope that's a vision that you have also for your children. You know, our culture is, as we've described over these last several weeks, you know, it's taken something that's really wonderful and good and that God created and turned it into one of the most potent forces of self-destruction that any human being has experienced in their life. And we live in a culture that is just absolutely dysfunctional in the area of their sexuality. And a lot of us here tonight are very dysfunctional in the area of our sexuality. And we wonder, how am I going to be able to work with my children to build into them something that was never built into me as a youth? And it's important as we end our discussion just to stand where God would have us stand, which is at the foot of the cross, to realize, you know, the trajectory of our life apart from God is very destructive. And we sense that and we feel the destruction that we've brought upon ourselves. And that can either mean then that that's just the way life is and life sucks and it's going to be over at some point or whatever, or just numb yourself to that, or what God is calling on us to do, which is to turn to Him, the great physician, as He calls Himself, the one who can take the broken wreckage of our life and by His grace piece it together, that by His grace, by His ability to work in our lives, can enable us to experience the depth and intimacy of relationships that He intended for us, to experience real forgiveness and reconciliation with other people because God extends to us the offer of being reconciled to Him. And maybe that's where we need to begin. Or do we know that we are reconciled to God in the sense that the Bible describes it, that we've taken that time to say, God, I believe that you came into this world through the person of Jesus Christ. I believe that you died a death on the cross. It was not just the death of a martyr, but was the death that you provided in substitution for my guilt. And I'm prepared, God, to just say, I want that payment for my guilt, for my sin. And I want to be reconciled, God, to you on the basis of the forgiveness that you can grant because Christ did this for me. And so I want to receive you into my life. That's what it means to be a Christian. It's not about not having made mistakes or New Year's resolutions to do better next year or whatever it is. It's about becoming reconciled with God through Christ. And it's just something that God has put out here as an offer, and He's calling on us. Will you respond to my desire to be reconciled with you? And when we find that God accepts us and that we are reconciled to Him, despite all of our guilt, then that gives us capacities then to enter into the very difficult lives of other people with that same mercy and that same grace, and to be real agents of redemption in their lives as well. Well, we're out of time. Why don't I pray for us? God, thanks for this time to think together about our kids, about our future, about our own lives. God, we really need you. We need to have you in our lives. We need your clarity. We need your power and strength. And I pray, Lord, that, because of the pertinence of this topic, that we would be drawing together and having the kind of discussions with our friends that we need to, that we could be a community of people that really produces whole people for another generation to lead. I pray, God, that you would restore the brokenness of our own hearts in this area from our own experiences, from the experiences of our children. And Lord, just that this area above all could stand out as an evidence of your grace and your mercy and your love. And that because of that, Lord, that we would have something so immediate and so powerful to convey to the world around us who is just so lost on this very point. Thanks for this time. Thanks for just the ability to have a kind of community where we can have open discussions like this. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.